This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 203, Robotic Monks. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on a wonderful Friday with my friend and co-host Michael Martin for another exciting, exciting episode of GamesAtWork.biz. How are you, Michael?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing peachy keen, listening to the mowers in the background, which are hopefully not getting picked up on the microphone, and thinking about robots.
Robot mowers?
Well, that probably would be even louder than the riding lawnmower and the guy with the weed whacker and the guy with the blower all in tandem going right. So maybe the robotic one would be louder, and but it would only be one, and I could hope they were slow and on the other side of the yard. But anyway, we have an exciting show this week. We're going to be tight on time, so it's going to be a short show, and we're starting with an article I found, about a week and a half ago,
yeah,
on a new robotic monk being created, or in use, actually, at a temple in China.
Well, my first reaction was, it looks like a Fisher-Price person.
And what's wrong with Fisher-Price?
Nothing's wrong with Fisher-Price. I love Fisher-Price. I remember the fireman and the mailman and all those guys.
Weren't the little Lego minifigs. What did they call them? Like Duplo figs? No, there was
Fisher-Price.
Another one. Yeah, but they had a name for them besides just Fisher-Price.
People, little people or something. I don't know.
Little people. He does kind of look like that.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I thought that was cool. The interesting thing about this particular robot was it didn't seem to have much in terms of expression. I mean, it has a face, it has eyebrows, nose, mouth, etc. I did not see any video around it, so I couldn't see it in action, but it seems like it's carrying a book, and maybe the interaction is limited to things that it's displaying on that screen from the book, and maybe audio.
Yeah, I was thinking two things from that picture, right? Obviously, the little computer screen / book or tablet, I'm sure there's interaction there. And it looks like the ears are mounted on plates attached to the roundness of the head. And yeah, in a way, you could imagine the ears rotating because that's what monks do.
Well, they could rotate their ears, or
that's
they
right.
could grab a pot with both arms on either side and get a dragon and a tiger.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So the interesting thing here is there's a lot of different apps out there on doing meditation and mindfulness. Matter of fact, Kevin Rose, who was one of the founders of a podcast you and I used to listen to years and years ago, Dignation, has a meditation app that he just released version 2 of. It's something like Grow or something like that.
Dude,
I've got to find the name and I'll put it in the show notes. And basically it does meditation exercises, and as you do the exercises, you go from a little acorn to a large tree. It grows the tree as you become more mindful and more meditative in the exercises they have you go through. And I was trying to figure out, the size of the robot that they show, at least in the picture, seemed kind of small to me. I would expect, something a little bit larger. This guy looks to be, about foot and a half, maybe 2 feet in height, and I would expect if you're walking into a monastery, a Buddhist temple, that it would at least be closer to life size.
Mm-hmm.
Given when I used to work on the island of Oahu, there was a temple right next to the office, and I remember walking by it and kind of looking in, and the open air nature of it. And there usually was either a monk there sitting or meditating or whatever. And, you know, I expect to see that same type of real life or even close to real life type environment if you're doing robotics, right? Especially, you know, given the nature of why you would go to the temple, right? You want to have that peace, that calm, that quiet, that centeredness, and then looking down at a, as you call it, Fisher Price robot, just doesn't seem to play well, at least with my mentality of what it should look like. Well, what are your thoughts?
So interesting on the meditation piece and from the article. It really, to me, seemed to have nothing to do with nothing. But where the point I was you're operating in a temple, which is kind of a sacred place. You probably want to communicate in hushed tones, so, or no tones whatsoever. So the interface with the tablet kind of seemed interesting, but then you're really just having a book on a stick, so to speak. I don't know. I mean, the interaction is that the thing's cute. So great. But so what? And it was designed for young visitors, they say here, right?
Yeah. I guess for young wizards is the right height.
Yeah.
It just seems to me, and this is why I put in our show notes a reference to a TV show I've been watching. It's on the second series now on AMC, which is a cable channel in the U.S., and called Humans. Mm-hmm. And the basic premise of Humans is there is a – this is, you know, sometime in the near future. I don't remember if they actually tell you the actual date. But most people no longer have to work because a company has created synthetics that pretty much do most work that people need to do. These synthetics have these – glowing green eyes, and they are effectively pure robots that look like humans, and they're, you know, you name the job, they do that job. And over the course of the first season, a small group of these synthetics are uncovered to have consciousness, and they've been working with the creator of the company to try to become more human, or at least have the rights of humans. And they go through kind of the discrimination aspects. You have aspects of the human population who don't know what to do anymore because they don't work. What does that do to self-worth? And the first series ends with a cataclysmic event with all the other synthetics, and there are millions of them globally, becoming conscience. And so the second series has just started a few months back, and it's really driven around the idea of humanity rebels and creates a new race of these synthetics with glowing yellow eyes to basically be slaves. And the old race of synthetics that are now much more human-like and have emotion and have sentient nature, etc., trying to establish rights for synthetics. And so when I saw this article originally, my thing was, you know, do synthetic robots have a god or religion? And in this story, Humans, a certain subgroup of the conscious robots or synthetics actually go off and start a religion around the creator. Right. And so it kind of got me thinking on, once a synthetic race or a robotic race become conscious, is this an inevitable thing to kind of explain it to themselves? Or because we have the source code, we have the mechanical drawings and the CAD/CAM drawings, they know the creator. The creator was, you know, humans because we built it, or robots themselves because they've evolved on their own to a point where they have sentience and start creating themselves. And so that kind of pulls it all together from what I saw in this article and the show that I've been watching. And I looked at that, and because this was a robotic monk, it kind of took you down the path of spiritualism, etc., around robotics.
Right. Now that all hangs together. I see.
Yes, it does. if you haven't watched the show Humans, highly recommend watching it. It's kind of a different take than what you... I haven't watched Westworld, but, you know, you've got a lot of... You've got multiple stories like this going on. You've got the old Battlestar Galactica from the early aughts. You've got Humans. You've got Westworld. And I'm sure there are others out there on, you know, what is the... What are the ethics around robots and spirituality?
Very interesting.
Yeah. And speaking of robots and spirituality, how fast would you run when a cheetah robot came charging up after you going upstairs?
Are we talking about a Thundercats cheetah, or are we talking
We are talking about a robotic cheetah from MIT.
Oh. Yeah, well, so, this is the one that's blind, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know that running would really help, Michael.
I know. So this was terrifying, mainly because, as you said, it's a blind cheetah, right? And it learns its walking through touch. And the example that the article kind of starts off is about the fact that it could walk up stairs that are covered in litter. But when you watch the rest of the video that's attached to it, I mean, this thing was pretty impressive. Galloping, slow walk, fast walk, you know, all the different types of four-legged motion that you would expect, and realizing it could do that without any sight or vision sensors, all through touch and other sensors, was pretty impressive, to me at least.
Well, I really like the article as it explained that robots that rely too heavily on vision, which can be clouded, imprecise, have a variety of problems, that not relying on vision actually is a stronger way to proceed. And then when you add vision to it in addition, can be a much better interface for that robot to interact with the environment.
Well, just think about it. I mean, we as humans can walk even if we are sightless.
Sure.
So it says there are other sensors in our bodies that allow us that ability to walk, and this is taking that same model and putting it into a mechanical device.
Yeah. Well, and when I watched the video, it looked a little like a prancing horse, you know.
They could also prance.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, when I was saying all these different four-legged motions, right? Mm-hmm. They actually show all the different ones it can do. Which, yeah, I mean, and the thing that I didn't understand is when do you use which type of motion, right?
Well, that's machine learning for you, right?
So right. Exactly.
You don't tell it; you let it experience it and figure it out.
So it says, in this case, prancing is better. Like, going upstairs kind of looks like a prance, mm-hmm, versus a gallop.
Right. Right.
And so, especially because there are all these, you know, pieces of wood that are loosely stacked up on the stairs that slide out of the way, and if you're prancing, you're not putting your full weight in any... Yeah.
And if you're slipping, you change as well. I mean, if you think about a U.S. football player, as opposed to the other kind of football that's going on in the world these days, that you change your leg locomotion depending on whether someone's trying to tackle you and you're trying to break out of the tackle, or whether you are in full-on sprint to get down the field.
Yeah. Well, and along the same line, you know, the fact on the vision thing, again, we keep going back in robotics of this nature to those types of robots that are used in rescue situations. And so if you're talking about in a fire environment where, you know, the ability to see is greatly degraded, it's much more important for the locomotion than for the visual aspect.
Like, wow, you know, awesome robot. At least this one wasn't scary,
no,
right?
No.
I mean, some of the ones out of this lab could get pretty scary and stuff. But going upstairs alone or in pairs where the stairs are impaired stairs, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Cool.
And the fact that it's sightless, I think, is good.
Well, especially, like we said, for rescue environments.
Yeah, right. I'm thinking about the Thai footballers, for example. You know, could you have used something like this? Or in addition to the Elon Musk sub, you put one of these robots in the sub and get the sub in, and then it can kind of scramble up.
Actually, if it were heavy enough, it could walk along the bottom without floating and pull the sub behind it.
Oh, that'd be kind of cool too, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Or if you could attach, you know, sort of gecko-like stuff to the feet, it could crawl along the top part of the cave.
It could, but I would think, given the time constraints of actually rescuing the kids, it would have been quicker just to walk along the bottom of the cave, which it normally can do.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, if you're underwater, you just keep walking.
Yep. Especially if you don't need to breathe or see.
Right, you just pack it up with stuff. You put food and oxygen and all kinds of stuff on there and say, go.
Cool. Well, we've got one more story in just a few minutes. And so this one actually came across a couple of different things. I saw this on my feed, and I also heard about it on another podcast. And this was an article on, and I can never remember how to pronounce this, Kotaku. Is that right?
Yeah, I will go with that.
The Kotaku gaming site on video game addiction and the fact that it is now actually starting to be recognized as
DSM.
A valid, yeah. And the DSM is?
Now you're going to make me remember what the acronym is. It's in
the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual.
Organization and by the current medical science as an actual disorder that is something that's addressable.
Yes. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. I used to remember it, and I was scanning down. I was hoping you remembered it. But anyway, yeah, so it's interesting because I keep wondering why this is considered a different disorder. When you think about the discussions that we've had all the way back at the beginning of all our podcasting of, you know, leveraging the addictive behavior of gaming to benefit business, right? Whether that's the little dopamine drip of I get a badge or I get some kind of reward for achieving a certain task. It seems to me that the inability to control the desire for the dopamine drip is kind of the general mental disorder. If you consider in 2013, that's when gambling finally got in the DSM. And is this truly something unique, or is it just another way of describing gambling, right?
I don't know. And I don't know that it's simply describing gambling. It's the nature of making an experience so compelling that you will seek that experience to the exclusion of all others, right? So gambling has that as a outcome, but that's not the input in my mind.
Well,
you're using mechanics to drive that behavior, which can yield financial ruin and a whole range of other things. And while the DSM may have only recognized gambling addiction as an addiction in 2013, it's not as if there were laws and treatments and all kinds of other things on the books well in advance of that.
No, I absolutely agree with that. And if you think about any of the addictive, the behavior-driven addictions, right? Alcohol, drugs, cigarettes, whatever, there's a chemical aspect that's triggered. And I'm not a doctor, so take this with a grain of salt, right? But I my mental model recognizes that there's a chemical addiction quality that kicks off the behavior, right? So you have that first, you know, that first shot of heroin or that first drink or whatever, and it triggers that chemical reaction in the brain. Is there a difference to the chemical reaction in the brain that's caused for behavior types addictions like gambling, like gaming, etc.?
Well, don't really know. I mean, neither one of us are doctors, so what we can work from is personal experience, and I think you and I both have had personal experiences playing games that are compelling, that are fun. And it's not too hard to see where compelling and fun can turn into lots and lots of time spent on things that are not necessarily worth it. And that can create buying behavior that sustain and enhance that same initial feeling that you had when you first started that you want to see continue. So, right? And we both stopped playing games because we recognize that that's the case and that's what's going on, right?
And so I guess the question becomes then from an industry perspective, right? Is it incumbent on the industry to say, hey, there are people that could trigger into this, you know, as a developer, my job is to make the most compelling and engaging game there is. I want you to spend all your time and money playing it so that I can make money because it's a business. But is it also incumbent on it to, you know, pop up a screen every once in a while and say, hey, why don't you go outside and play, right?
That will fix it?
I don't know. I mean, the drugs and alcohol, they have, you know, warnings on cigarette cases. They have, you know, alcohol has their little messages on their ad saying, don't forget, drink responsibly. Is there a time, or will there become a time where the industry will have to start doing that in order to address what is being perceived and recognized now as a real gaming disorder by the World Health Organization?
Whether or not there's a warning label is immaterial to me, right? How many things exist with a warning label, like a ladder or certain ingestible or consumable substances? And does that particular label or the Surgeon General's warning or have enough of an impact to dissuade people from becoming addicted to substances that are inherently addictive?
Well, if it's truly a chemical addiction triggered by an event, right? And again, not a scientist in this space at all, then there's that 1% or 0.1% or whatever the percentage that will become addicted no matter what you do, to your point. But should you at least warn people of it? Or do you say, hey, some people are just going to be addicted. It's just a game. No warning. This is a tough discussion, and I don't think either of us are going to have an answer here, because it hits to the point of what's going on with video game addiction. And I really think over the next 5-10 years, this is going to be something that has to be addressed or validated or whatever to figure out what's going on here. It was a really good discussion, I believe, in this article on what it is, and people should take a read and kind of, think of their own opinion on this and figure out what's going on. But I thought, given the nature of our podcast, we had to at least recognize this article and point it out there for people to look at.
Yeah. So my take on this is that it's a broader subject, and a warning label is a way to absolve oneself of potential legal action. Hey, I warned you and you decided to do it anyway. You have full control over your faculties. To me, it's much more interesting to think about the means and the ways that experiences are crafted in such a way to encourage the person that the experience is targeted for to come and have that experience again and again and again. And that was one of the things that got me interested in our podcasting here together already years and years and years ago. And one of the things that, while this was a good article and certainly a long one, the book from Adam Alter, a recent book called Irresistible, deals with this subject in even more depth. And I had a chance to finish reading it, which was sort of on my reading list for a long time last week while I was on vacation. And I was really glad to have that opportunity to really immerse myself in the story, because it's not just a game. There are ways of shopping. There are ways of gathering news and information that are all designed to keep you playing, if you will, for one more turn. And that is neither good nor bad in my mind. It is. And having the ability and the skill for knowing how and when to turn things off is an important thing, more important in my mind than being warned, because you can warn people about, hey, you know, don't jump off a bridge, and people will jump off a bridge, hopefully with a bungee cord, more often anyway, because that's, you know, the warning's there, but people do things even though there are warnings.
Right? Yeah, I get your point. I don't think, you know, have the ability to turn it off is something that exists if you are truly addicted. I think there's a chemical medical reason, and that's why the warning at least says don't start.
So a great point of contention. So let me flip it just a little bit, and I'll use an example from the book. One of the things that people have been doing in the last few years is what's called binge watching. So it's fun to call something binge watching, that you might watch, what was the name of your thing, Humans, that you might watch not just one episode, but like six in a row. And if it's a 45-minute episode, that's a decent chunk of your time when you're not spending time with friends and family or eating or whatever, right? You're like, oh my gosh, I'm super engrossed in this TV show because it's really, really cool and I find it interesting. And the concept of a TV show, as I'm sure our listeners are well aware, is to end something with a cliffhanger. Dun, dun, dun. And the cliffhanger will make you go, well, gosh, I'll just watch one more episode, one more turn, right? So there are techniques that can be learned, discovered, experienced, so that you don't fall into that trap. So you might say, look, I've got 2 hours to spend. I know there's going to be cliffhangers. So what I'll do is I won't end at episode 4, you know, because that's what I have enough time to do. What I'll do is I'll watch through the first 15, 20 minutes of episode 3, and I'll stop there, because at that point, the cliffhanger from episode 2 is resolved enough, typically to a point in a 30, 45 minute show, you know, when you take out the commercials and such, that you have at least enough of a, oh, okay, that's what happened with the cliffhanger, now I stopped.
Yeah, I don't think I agree to the correlation between the two, but definitely think it's something that, like I said at the beginning of the discussion, I recommend that our listeners go read the article, read the book if you want to monetize addictive behavior, and look at it from a purely business perspective. That's great. And maybe drop us a comment on the blog post for this show over at gamesatwork.biz, episode 203. We'd love to hear from you. And I know we're out of time, but Michael, you have had time on your vacation to play a game.
I have. And, you know, for all of you who might get sucked into games, let me warn you, don't start playing this because it's addictive and it will suck up all your time and money. So the game's called Rodeo Stampede. It's available on different kinds of platforms. People familiar with me will go, oh, look, here's another kind of 8-bit sort of thing. And it's like, yeah, it is. And the premise behind this game, it's a endless runner where you are a little rodeo guy and you land on an animal and you ride the animal for a little while, and then you have to then jump to the next one. So you might be on a zebra or an elephant or something like that. And it's got a collect-em-all aspect, a little bit like Disco Zoo, which is another one of my favorite games as well, where you can collect animals and you can have little baby animals and different kinds of elephants and different other stuff. And the game kind of evolves and opens up from there. So fun game. Actually, it's not that addictive to me, but it has some monetization aspects to it if you want to buy particular skins and stuff like that and speed up the wait times.
Yep. So, and I looked at this when you posted it. So how is it in iMessage?
Oh, I haven't played it in iMessage.
Looks like it adds stickers to your iMessage. So that was,
oh, yeah, probably so. Yeah. So you could send a sticker to somebody of a little giraffe you lassoed.
Woohoo.
Yeah.
Well, good.
Anything
I'm glad.
From you, Michael? Or,
nope.
Or nope. Not really. Just
nope.
TV.
Still nope. 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 I think that puts us right out of time. And once again, drop us a note over at gamesatwork.biz or at our Twitter account at @gamesatwork @Bill_Biz.
Biz.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
See ya.
Bye.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter @GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.